71A3 in Masechet Sanhedrin of Ar Gemara. Good you made it in the rain. So, we were at a pinnacle moment in the Gemara's discussion of the case of the stubborn and rebellious son, in the sense that if there's one position in the Talmudic tractate that is a position that shows philosophically where we stand about this possibility that parents would ever drag a child to the town elders to say that this child deserves to be stoned, and we could stand within that conception of a system of law that would allow for such punishment, stoning at the ultimate after the trial with 23 justices that make up the Sanhedrin. If we could see that, okay, but if you can't really see that philosophically ever really being something that we could as Jewish people condone, put into action, even have as part of our jurisprudence, have experienced once, a la, you know, Eichmann, and the death penalty happened once in Israel, and that's it. Here we have the Gemara telling us, come on, this can't be. This can't be. And the way it starts into the notion of this can't be is through a braita where Rebbe Yehuda explains what our Mishnah, in this case, on 71a2 says. The Mishnah purported to say, Haya aviv rotze ve'imo eina rotza. The father wanted to have him declared a ben sora more, and the mother doesn't wish, or a case, aviv eino rotze, a father doesn't want, but ve'imo rotza, but the mother does want. Eino nasa ben sora more. So they have to have what? One voice, because it said back in Deuteronomy, Bekol avivu bekol imo, with the voice of his mother and the voice of his father. So if it says the voice of his mother and the voice of his father, I need to have it be that they actually have the same, what, thinking, one might say, if we're to read the word kol, the voice of the person, as what one thinks. Rabbi Yehuda wants to go so far as to say, no, it doesn't even mean that. It means literally. They have to have the same voice, tone, quality, thought, expression. And by the way, I also am going to teach you in a braita, now I'm back on 71A3, left-hand column, Tanya Namihachi, it was taught thusly in a braita, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Im lo haitayimo shava le'aviv, if a boy's mother was not similar to his father, bekol uvemare uvekoma, in voice, in appearance, or in height. Eino nase ben sore more. He can't ever be made into ben sore more. So show me a case, right, where someone has a set of parents who are exactly the same in voice, the same in appearance, and the same height. My Tama, what's the reason for the requirements? De Amar Kra, that the verse actually says in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, Einenu Shomea Bikolenu. It didn't just say the voice of the father and the voice of the mother. At one point it uses our voice, kolenu. And if the word is our voice, it has to meet the requirement of being the same tonality, in essence, thought and tone, according to this physical trait. And Rabbi Yehuda taught not only the physical trait of the voice, but the same stature physically. So the Gemara cites another braita associated with all this, the braita being about our case of Ben Sora and More, the stubborn and rebellious son. B'man azla haditanya. Whose opinion is reflected in this braita? So why did the editor exactly put it here? Because the editor, in light of the fact that Rabbi Yehuda just taught us that not only is the voice having to be similar, but the stature, the height, all this stuff that can't possibly really be, we get this following braita, because the editor wants to tell us, this is the shita, this is the approach of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda's approach is to come up with such a way to explain the requirements of this legal case to the point where it was adjudicated so far out of the system, and here's the way he really expresses that, guys. Don't learn from that, Breita only, where he said the person has to have the same voice, same height, same stature, same physical girth. What he's really saying is this. Even though it's asking a question, like, so who said this, Breita, as well, about the one we're about to learn? It's really not saying, so who said this, Breita? It's really saying, what he's really saying is this. When he teaches you that, he's saying what? Ben sorer more lohaya, such a rebellious child never was, velo atid lehiot, and in the future will never be. You'll never have a case like this. No possible way. Velama nichtav, and so why then does the Torah write it? Drosh v'kabel sachar. Because it's for you to learn, for you to use hermeneutical learning devices and methodologies, and through Torah learning, you receive a reward. You're clarifying God's will, you're thinking about what these verses really imply in terms of a society that needs to set up to deal with such things. It may create certain injunctions, yes, on a criminal statutory basis, but it also creates a certain approach to discipline, education, learning that you need to take very seriously. Lo haya, it was never. Lo ati lihiyot, not for the future can this ever be. And you're going to make that happen. And the reason why you're going to make that happen is because you're learning Torah. And the reward is inherently that this will never happen. And in and of itself, Talmud Torah is worth it. Even when it sounds almost outlandish. The notion that the rabbis have a Talmudic culture, a learning culture, is as important as the notion philosophically here that how could we ever bring a child up on such charges? That's proven by the point that the rabbis have certain elemental understandings of Torah passages that what they hold is that they were never going to happen either. But the reason why they were given to you in Torah is so that you could actually be in the midst of learning and understanding them through midrashic process, through the process of Talmud Torah, through the mitzvah of engaging, through the legal exercise that it takes to actually get there, through the brain stretching, through the actual use of this muscle. And not just this. The culture of Talmud Torah, according to Daniel Boyarin, the scholar out on the West Coast about Talmudic literature, is the culture that is over and against that of the arena, that of the bodybuilding, that of the perfecting of body. It's the perfecting of mind. It's the approach to sharpening one's acumen and approaching the world and asking about family structure and asking about criminality and asking about what it is we do with holy texts. And we not only accept them for what their simple sense is, but we move into this realm of taking our understandings and going forward. Listen to how it's continued. Rabbi Yehuda, it's in accordance with the view of Rabbi Yehuda that this person was never found out to be a ben sorer more. Rabbi Yehuda's position. Rabbi Shimon, if you want to say that Rabbi Shimon, it reflects the view of Rabbi Shimon. Because I have another writer that says, the Tanya, Ama Rabbi Shimon, v'chi mipnei she'achal ze, tartemar basar, because this is a boy who ate a tartemar of meat, v'shata chasilog yayin ha'atalki, and drank half a log of Italian wine, aviv imo motzino totalis sachlo. His father and mother will take him out to be stoned. Ela lo haya v'lo ati lihiot. Rather, there never was a ben sorer more, and nor will there be one in the future. V'lama nichtav d'rosh v'kabel sachar. Because God said, expound it and receive reward for doing so. The Braita cites, though, a dissenting view. Amar Rabbi Yonatan, but Rabbi Yonatan said the following, Anira itiv, I did see one. V'yashavti al kivro, and I sat upon his grave. If it was Rabbi Yehuda, who said, when the Torah said kolenu, one voice, it has to be the exact same voice. And I, by the way, am telling you that it's got to be the exact same body type and the exact same girth, exact same height, and all the things. If it was Rabbi Yehuda, and his position was, never will be, I see that Rabbi Yehuda is saying, if you're going to read the hyper-pashat of the text, if you're going to read the text exactly as it stands, with the voice of the mother, the voice of the father, and then the plural word kolenu, their voice, our voice, being one voice, I'm going to tell you, that can never happen. You'll never fulfill the exact words of Torah to get to this place of having a ben sorer more. Oh, but the Gemara says, that's one way of looking at it. Rabbi Shimon says, it's a little bit simpler than that. He goes and he eats tartamar of meat, and he drinks chatzi log of Italian wine. He drinks this, and you look at him time and time again, and you say, this is a glutton. This is a no good. This is a no goodnik. In the end, he's going to turn into a drunkard. In the end, he's going to turn into a murderer. Are Jewish parents really going to bring that child all the way to the court of 23 judges? Rabbi Yonatan says in response, as that Rabbi Shimon teaches, I saw it once. Once. I sat on his grave. Either we learn from the one time how awful it was, or we saw, I mentioned Eichmann, that it could only happen once in multiple generations. And the other position is, just be logical. How could you possibly legislate this? That's Rabbi Shimon's. Rabbi Yehuda is saying, be careful about how you're reading Torah. You may not be able to fulfill every detail and use the grammar to understand exactly what needs to happen. Here with Ben Sorer More, with a stubborn and rebellious son, thank God we read like that. Because who wants this to really happen, philosophically? We never want to stone a kid.
Question. When they talk about the parents speaking in one voice, common sense logically, one would say the parents have to be conveying the same message. If one says do this, the other says I forbid you to do this, one says do that, the other says,
right, that's our understanding, reading listens to the voice of his mother, the voice of his father.
Right. So it's logical that if you're getting mixed signals from your parents, you're going to displease one of them at any given time. But Rabbi Yehuda actually puts it in physical terms. That does he mean what he's saying, that physically? I mean, I know his motive regardless is to say, forget about it, this is not what we do, it never happened and it never will happen.
I'm suggesting the editor knows that he's using such terminology and an approach to the text to show us
that
it's not really ever going to happen and it could never really happen. And even when people agree and they're on the same page, by the way, are they really on the same page? And plus, should we ever get them on the same page as bringing their kid to the court?
You know, when we first started reading this, okay, I was on the same wavelength as most of us, that this was an exaggeration that could never happen. In the last couple of months, living through all of these adolescent shootings, okay, with guns and things like that, this topic has more currency now, okay, than it did, at least to me.
Mm.
Or so ago. And, you know, I wonder if we're not not too quick, okay, you know, to dismiss it, okay, in terms of just an intellectual exercise, okay, in terms of...
Rabbi Yonatan agrees. In other words, there is a position at the end of this, at the end of the Braita, that said, I have seen this. So we could read it that in that light that you're suggesting now, and that it's not just saying it's only once in a multiple generations. I think you're right. I think you're right to say that, by the way, if you don't create the system that's going to take care of some of the problems that we've discussed on these very pages, you could be looking at the proliferation of murder. This is the machloket as well that is put forward in the Gemara itself when it comes to the death penalty, which was referenced back at some point, either I did, as well as the first semester we were learning. The argument is if you don't put to death at least some people who deserve it, then you're not keeping the entire society safe. You're proliferating murders in Israel. And so, as even if you want to just call that a hava amina, which in Gemara means the straw man, it is challenging us to take that very seriously and to create response, because the nature of some of these human beings is to have these inclinations. So I do think the currency is being weighed by Rabbi Yonatan here, and for sure in our Beit Midrash should be looked at seriously as well.
I have 3 points that I want to make. I'll start with the last one of Rabbi Yonatan. The story of Rabbi Yonatan, agreed with you, is can be immediately nulled because he sat on the grave and you're not allowed to sit on graves. So the whole story is a little bit questionable.
That's what the footnote says. Right, with the Meiri brought that up back in the centuries ago. You're right.
So that's questionable.
You could, except right. That some people sit very close when they're saying Psalms, even in Israel today.
But not on the grave itself. In Israel, you cannot sit on the grave because they're so crowded together that it's like, forget about it. So that's for, you cannot even walk to your grave. So that's a different story. So that the second point is, you mentioned the rabbis put it so we can study and deduct some learning out of it, so we can get a sahar out of the learning. But the point of it, are the editors of the Bible, which were minimalistic, they always wrote as little as possible, agreed with the rabbis of today to put it in, because if they knew that it would never happen, why did they even put it in? And I'm talking about the people who edit the Bible, not the Gemara and the Mishnah. So if they knew that this is just an exercise, and they put it in, why didn't put so many other exercises of that period, which we knew there were, and they are not shown in the Bible. And the third point is vote and call. In Hebrew, call is a vote, like political vote, like when you vote for something. So I think the argument of the Shema Kuleinu here, which you call the voice of the mother or the vote, it's not just called the voice, it's the vote of the mother, which means that she has a political or social background, the same the father, and it's like a political parties. They both need to agree on the whole spectrum of issues as a vote, when you vote for something. So when you count call in Hebrew, you count votes. Mm-hmm. You don't count voices.
Interesting linguistic point. Vis-a-vis the second point, we're going to read through a couple of pieces on the page, on the daf. You'll see if you can see within the editorial choices, if you approach the Bible that way, some light on your second question. The Gemara will speak more than I can. Carol?
I was talking about the footnote, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you discount, I mean, what is your opinion on the footnote?
My opinion on the footnotes is that, like with this project, the Schottenstein edition, they choose certain footnotes, like any good editorial board or group would. Oftentimes they're choosing Rishonim that take the most traditional perspective, if there's any legal matter, because that's this publishing house. which is one approach all the time. The Art Scroll will take that approach, that since it's Asur in Halakha today, since it's forbidden in Halakha today, and it was at the time of Rabbi Meir, obviously it was forbidden back in the time of Rabbi Yonatan. That's a large leap, because we know that the Hitzachut Shel HaHalakha, the development of the Halakha, and the understandings of what people did and where they sat and where they didn't sit. Now, we know from the fact that Kohanim, for instance, back in that time of Rabbi Yonatan, did not enter the cemetery, just like they don't today. But we don't...
Except it was your own family.
Right. But we don't know necessarily if different people had different traditions.
But it said there that he was going in the
cemetery, right? Right. So that's assuming, again, that this Rabbi Yonatan was Rabbi Yonatan HaKohen. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at the Meiri as being authoritative, somewhat. We also need to see that his language is not literal, just like the language of Torah is not literal. So I saw him once and I sat in his grave. Does that mean, really, that he's telling you that he actually went to sit on the spot in the cemetery? Or does that mean I was part of the group of 23 justices at the time? In other words, there's no reason to only go with that being the literary, actually the shot read, in other words, that I sat physically on the grave. That is what's called a literary approach to the language of Talmud versus a simple sense and straightforward shot of Talmud. So, again, the Meiri is a fantastic source. Is that who it's from, by the way? What footnote is that?
25.
No,
then makes other references to other
sources. Oh, it's even giving you later sources,
yeah.
Which is way past Meiri's 14th century. It's giving you, you know, Pisrei Tshuva to Yoredeia being part of 14th century and 16th century codific literature. So I think, you know, some of that has to be really taken into account as you're reading these footnotes. So thank you for the question for about footnotes.
What is the tartar of meat and why Italian wine?
Okay, so that was, just to review quickly, Tartamer is a measure, Italian wine, because it was strong, really, really got you into an addictive mode, and then made you go kill, according to Rashi, because you were going after this, and you were stealing money to get it.
The other way to say about I saw one, and I sat on it, I was a judge, I had a rule, and I sit on it, it bothers me, I remember it for my whole life.
Yeah. I mean, that is the side that says, how can we possibly let this proliferate?
Right.
Versus, let's take this really seriously. I have seen the need for this in terms of our adjudication.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are quite apparent, mm-hmm. even within, you know, the currency of death penalty discussions, right? You have a certain group of beliefs that the death penalty in and of itself creates less recidivism. It stops certain murder in its track. Other groups want to claim and show statistics that in areas where current death penalty is given, the number of murders in any given place rises for that period of time, X number of months afterwards. You know, these Talmudic debates were modeled in our Talmud. Let me show you, though, in terms of with Ron's question about the Bible and are there other cases that are brought for the same reason, and did the editors of the Bible include things that, again, they even, or the Bible, you know, was it given with the sense that there will be cases here, items that are only for learning and not for actual happenings or for to be adjudicated? We continue on. A similar dispute about another law. 71A3, right-hand column. Kaman Azla Haditanya, whose opinions reflected in the following Braita. Ir Hanidachat Lo Haita. There never was a subverted city, meaning a city where most people worshipped idols, and if it was shown to be a majority, that city should be entirely destroyed. Entirely destroyed. Wiped out. Below Atidalhiot, and it never will be in the future. So it never was and it never will be. Velama nichtava, so then why write it? Drosh v'kabel sachar, learn it out, do the Talmud Torah on it, receive your reward. Come on. Whose brightness does that reflect? Who are we talking about here? Rabbi Eliezer. That's like the view of Rabbi Eliezer, who says, the Tanya in a brighta, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, kol ir sheyesh ba afilu mezuzah chat, any city that even has one mezuzah, ein anaseit ir hanidachat, can never become a subverted city. So in other words, I'm never going to call the Jews of one city. I'm not talking about Canaanites, by the way. I'm making a ruling here that these people are idol worshippers. These Israelites are idol worshippers. They're not really part of our group. We're not including them in the, you know, Toshav, in the settlement of the land of Israel, because we're talking biblical time. I can't, if there's one mezuzah, one, can't be destroyed. Because a single mezuzah in that case is a davar bakodesh. It's a holy item. It's a small scroll with the name of God. And if I have that, then there's no way I can destroy the city, because I can't possibly destroy that. Rashi adds, afilu mezuzah achat. It's in the narrow part of Rashi, about 20 lines down. Va'afilu mezuzah achat. V'choshekin achad min hachumashin. And all the more so if there was a chumash. Right? A chumash meaning not like Hertz chumash or the Eitz Chaim chumash bound in a little book with all five books of the Torah plus your haftaras. A chumash means one-fifth. And it was rolled up. Because in order to have the full Torah back then, you needed to have a box that, you know, imagine a box like, you know, you go to the post office today. The closest thing I can use to explain it, if you go to the post office and you can buy mailing tubes. So ancient synagogues had a box like that, and or a box that had a lid that was tall enough so that you could store holy scrolls. And the five scrolls of Torah, plus some others, books of prophets, and some believe in ancient times, a scroll, classical times, anyway, Talmudic times, that scroll of Haftarot was written. So you had different scrolls. So forget a mezuzah. You definitely couldn't destroy it with a mezuzah, but even more definitely, you can't destroy it if it has one of the scrolls of the Torah in the city. Oh, sefer mikol hanavim, or even a scroll of the prophets. As kirvat Hashem kituvasham, that the name of God is written in below kirina be et koslala v'sarachta, and you can't say that you're going to now destroy this and entirely burn down the city if you have those there. So the Gemara asks, my Tama, what's the reason for Rabbi Eliezer's ruling? Amar krav et kol shlala tikbot el toch rechova v'sarafta v'esh. Because you have to gather the booty of all the city and burn it in the square. God knows you can't do that if you have a mezuzah, and plus, if you have a chumash or you have a scroll of the prophet's writings, you're definitely not going to do that. And since there's a mezuzah in the booty, ikka mezuzah, lo efshar. It's not possible to do so. So they knew about the holiness of written items in at least the rabbinic times and pre-rabbinic times, because there was an age before the rabbis of those who were in power called sofrim. What's a sofer today? A sofer is someone who writes mezuzah scrolls, chumash scrolls. But there's a movement of leaders within our people after the prophets and before the actual rabbis called the Sofrim. More and more scholarship is being done about this time period as we reveal a little bit more archaeologically, as we reveal a little bit more in the thought process. But the practice of actually writing ancient scrolls and ancient texts and having a mezuzah that's actually a scroll and not just kind of carved into a lintel, we see from some of the oral traditions that the rabbis have within the Talmud.
Is that why they mentioned in the Amidah that pray for the Sofrim and the judges? I always wondered why they were there.
We pray for the Sofrim?
I'll find it.
Pray for the Tzaddikim? trying to think if I know a nusach that has sofrim.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. So we see that they actually had this tradition of safrut, of actually making. Now, turn the page, 71A4. Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Anira Itiya v'yashavti al tila. But I saw one of these cities, and I sat upon its ruins. So Rabbi Yonatan has a kind of position here about text.
He has a shtick.
And that is...
I think he was a Ben Forever Moritz.
I
think he's the guy. If we would eliminate him, we would have
So yeah, maybe he's the exam. Maybe this is the literary currency in the Gemara. Is such a person in the Beit Midrash? We can't control a dispute as to another law. Come on, Azla Hadatanya. Whose opinion is reflected in the following brayta? Beit Haminuga lo haya v'lo ati lihiot. There never was a tsaras affected house. There never was a house that had leprosy. You wrote in the Torah that a house could get leprosy. Never was. Never will be. V'lama nichtav. And why was it written? Again, same reason. Drosh v'kabel zachar. Because you're going to learn it. You're going to drush it out. You're going to find some homiletical meaning, maybe. You're going to use the hermeneutical principle. And you're going to learn. And you're going to sharpen your mind. But it never was. Come on. But whose opinion does this reflect? Could Rabbi Elazar... But Rabbi Shimon, this is in accordance with Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, the Tanan, as we learn in a Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar, but Rabbi Shimon Omer, La'olam ein ha-bayit tamei. A house never becomes tamei as a result of sarat, leprosy, what we understand as leprosy.
It's
not mold? It's not mold. We don't exactly know what biblical sarat is, by the way. All the way back from articles in medical journals that deal with these kinds of issues, you know, the idea of tzara'at leprosy in the Bible, is it really the leprosy that we define today in the journal of, you know, doctors who care for leprosy? We don't exactly know, but we do know that it's not mold.
And a building.
But there are hot, sick houses.
Yeah,
today we see that with water.
And that's mold.
And it's mold.
Or disease.
And it could be that they have certain kind of elements of germs. And so, is the Torah pointing us towards that? Want to say that the Torah is including the chapter because on a practical level, you need to really do a good job cleaning your house? That's great. That's drosh v'kapel sachar. But the fact that we declare it tamei entirely, impure, and thus, you know, kind of have to do whatever the process calls for, adjudicating among Israel... never was, according to this Mishnah. However, it did have a certain measure. Ad shiyirei k'shtei grisim al shtei avanim. And so you see two sides of gris markings of tzara'at on two stones. B'shtei katalim b'keren zavit. Located on two walls that actually form a corner. Okay, so you have to have these two markings. So my time of the Rabbi Elazar by Rabbi Shimon, what's the reason of Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon? Because the Gemara says, Ketiv, Kir Uchativ Kirot. In the second section of the verse, it's written wall, but in the first section, it's written walls. Ezu Kir Shehu Kirot. And what's a wall that's like two walls? It's actually the meeting of two places in a corner. And so, again, very detailed kind of reality that has to be met in order to actually declare this house to be full of tzara'at. The position originally, though, is never really was. Albeit that you could have some problems in the house that you have to deal with. They didn't want to get to a level, obviously, of declaring this.
But these are modern day. There's radiation, there's things in the wall that are poisonous, but that's more modern day than...
Correct. And they didn't have, you know, drywall like we have either.
Right.
We're talking about stones.
Talking
about... Last part before the next Mishnah. Tanya was taught in a Braita. Ama Rabbi Eliezer, but Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Tzadok, says, Makom haya b'tachom Aza. There was a place within the boundary of Aza. V'hayu korin oto chorvata segirta. And they called it a house of ruins of tzara'at, of ruins of leprosy. So that's testimony that, in fact, it was. And at this time, it's not the same good old Rabbi Yonatan. So it's actually not that we have one notion of picking on one guy who's Yer Ben Sorer More, though it looked like that before. And actually, here we go, Amar Rabbi Shimon, Ish Kfar Akko, and Rabbi Shimon, who lives in Akko, Pa'am Achat Halachti LeGalil, one time I went up to the north, to the Galil, V'ra'iti Makom Shemitzayinin Oto V'amru, and I saw a place that they had a marking on, and it said what? Avanim Minuga'ot Pinusham. They have removed Sira'at afflicted stones to there. In other words, there's a afflicted, there's an afflicted stone. Well, the connection here is that it's coming in the lineup of this argument of the Gemara, so we imagine that they're connecting it to that. But you're right, you could say, in good Rishonim fashion, wait a minute, that seems to be far removed from the issue of a house. No one said we took these out of a house and put them there. That kind of language adjustment would be important to several Rishonim commentators. What it's showing you, though, is that at certain points, people do stand up and say, you think it's only for learning, you think it's only just because it'll never happen. In fact, maybe it might. The notion that people answer very, and this was kind of back to the point here, people say, Ben Sorer More, oh, I know the answer to that, I've learned that Gemara. Lo haya, v'lo yehiyah. Never was, never will be. But now we have a more sophisticated answer. The Gemara purports that such a case never was and never will be. It's true. But the Gemara also, in each case that it purports that, brings you an opinion that says, no, I've actually seen that. Whether or not it's seen 20 times, 50 times a year by courts across the land, this one was over here, and this one had to go to the Galil to see it, and that one had to go to a cemetery to be there, or he was talking about a time that he's a justice. It's not that there's a proliferation of this. It's that I did see it once. So maybe we ought to just think twice before we say, absolutely, it never happened. That kind of understanding of this part of the Gemara definitely lends itself to being careful community planners, respondents when it comes to the law, if you're reading this as a justice, to be cognizant that perhaps it could be. In general, though, the philosophy comes across both by Rabbi Yehuda and by Rabbi Shimon that, come on, can they really speak with one mind to bring him to this crowd of elders to actually have the kid stoned? Does anyone really, could we imagine any parents really being on that page? Can we say, he ate this much, he drank this much, we're going to, in essence, bring him to court because we really do take care of the problem now and stone him to death, even if he does something that we have to penalize him for criminally later? So I think that that is the larger picture of what's going on in this part of the Gemara. It's still going to go on a little bit, the Mishnayot, to do some of the same work that we've been doing. There's two more Mishnahs left that really are the close of this part of the chapter. The chapter does move off of this topic to a very interesting question about whether or not we really can punish people not only because of the here and now, but because of what we imagine they will do or be in the future. That is a very compelling legal question.
I'm back, I have to step, but the people in that time, I imagine, like you all, were very fearful of God, and they read something in the Torah that says you might have to stone your kid. I think both sets of rabbis are reinforcing to the people that there's humanity. On one hand, they're saying, no, this will never happen. And then the other rabbis come up, well, I saw it happen once. Well, that still does not make it seem like this is something that's prevalent and that all these kids are going to be stoned to death. So even by saying, all right, in the rarest instance, it happened once, that gives people some comfort that this is not going to happen in their community or in their lifetime.
Mm. So the from both perspectives, the measures of humanity.
Right.
Maybe. Nice. It's not back half a step. I think that is also getting at what's the real nature here. The question is, what's the real nature of the Gemara's discussion?
There's a kind of a hint in this whole discussion about not just the relationship between the child and parents, but between humanity and God. Maybe there's an overriding anxiety about what are the consequences of not fulfilling our obligations, our duties to God under the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
We think the consequences are our destruction. We will be punished for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of a argument here. Well, yes, God says he will punish us, but he'll never really do it. And then comes the guy who says, well, you know, I remember Sodom and Amorah, which were completely destroyed. And the discussion is similar. Abraham says, well, what if I find 100 men who are righteous, wise, can't find anybody? And the flood in the time of Noah. So somebody said, well, I actually know about a case where God really destroyed all of mankind. I know of a case. I've been there. I've seen the stones where God actually punished an entire community or a nation for their sins.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we feel that we're doing our best to listen to the voice of our God,
mm-hmm.
and to be obedient. And if we err, we hope that there won't be these kind of consequences, although we know about them and we've heard about them.
If I were to attach what your remarks are now to anything in the sugya, I would say that the phrase that I'm linking to what your observation is really packed into drush v'kabel sachar. In other words, you know, the notion that you'll receive some reward, this is not some, you know, reward that's less than divine. Right, so it doesn't have to be about the understanding of the meaning of the words. Could be very much linked to more of what you're saying now. The deep relationship, the attempt to understand it, to negotiate that.
Got it. Hashiva Shoftenu.
Hashiva Shoftenu. So return our judges. Our judges. So the judges in the period of the judges, and the judges of the rabbinic era, if they're making reference to them there, and people really have understood that to be both, little different than the actual movement of Sofrim themselves, but the notion that anybody would sit in a place of judgment, the Sofrim also were the judges of their day. So that term really is asking historically for a relationship with all of these people who adjudicated our lives through the lens of Torah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, what I would like to do is I'd just like to mention to you that the next Mishnah works like this. They go through asking if anybody was lame, blind, deaf, mute, could they really still bring their child up on charges. I want to point out the following. I had a class with Rabbi Richie Lewis at the yeshiva in Jerusalem. He is now the head of the conservative yeshiva in the Beit Agron, Merkaz HaYahadut Shel HaConservativim Baaretz, the conservative Jewish center in Israel. They're very interesting teacher. So the rabbis had very definite conceptions about what it meant to be deaf, lame, mute. People were not required to follow mitzvot in the same way in that crowd. The rabbis conceived of people with those types of disabilities as being not only handicapped physically, but have a deeper propensity to become upset. You know, whether we understood the nature of people who faced those challenges and whether or not people embraced them at all, it was not really the parlance of any relationship to this community, the deaf, the mute. And so the Mishnah here, for sure, just immediately kind of says, they obviously can't do it. They obviously can't be in the same place as neurotypical parents whose voices could be the same, who's rationalizing with one another, who's understanding the judicial process could work. So it goes back through some of the pieces that we have learned before. Could it be that they had one voice, Kolenu? Well, how could one have a voice? They didn't even really have a voice to use. Could they hear his wail? Things like this. I think that it's interesting that the discussion that happens on 71b1, if you turn there, they ask the question, so how are they going to do this? How are they going to actually warn it? Because we require a warning. And one interesting piece that comes to light in this next section of the Gemara is the fact that, oh, there was a little bit more than just they bring them to the town elders. There's a whole process here. And so some of our observations that it did require and encourage society to set up a system where there was some level of not only education, but really standing a child before the right authorities to say, careful, because one wrong move after this, and you could be looking at standing before 23 judges, really did exist in their systemic approach to what this world of Ben Sorer More would have to go through and what these parents would have to go through. So 71b1.
Can a lame, deaf, and blind be a witness in a court outside of this case for any case?
I would have to review the entire issue.
You see the analogy?
Yeah, I do. I would have to review all the sources about, you know, that specific question to answer. My inclination would be that we would see more sources that would nullify that than make it possible. 71b1, the Mishnah says the following. Umatrin bifnei shlosha, and the parents warn him before three, and he's flogged. Lamali, why do we need three witnesses? Betray sagya, two should suffice to convict the boy. The Gemara answers, Amar Abaye, Hachi Kamar, this is what the Mishnah means to say. Matrin bo bifnei shnayim, the parents warn the boy before two witnesses. Malkino to bifnei shlosha, and if he continues to overindulge, he's flogged before a court of three. Now, flogging is a punishment. It's not stoning. Here we had an instance where he was overindulging. They bring him before three justices after he's warned in front of two witnesses that he has to stop, and he receives the flogging.
Just thought, the parents bring him before the three judges. Do the judges have to agree before he gets flogged? The same way, if you go before 23 judges, how often are you going to get 23 judges?
Well, the court has to
agree when the parents say yes.
No, the way that someone's convicted is that the court decides.
Majority rule.
So yeah, the court has to make that ruling. The Gemara presents this scriptural source for imposing this punishment. Malkut b'ven sorer more hecha ketiva. How do we know that flogging is written in connection to this case of the ben sorer more? Could the Rabbi Abahu? That's because Rabbi Abahu said the following. Da'ama Rabbi Abahu, lamadnu vayisru mi vayisru. Rabbi Abahu says, I know that this is the process and this is the actual first step in terms of punishing this trial, because I have what's called in midrashic parlance, to actually go back to the notion of that you're going to make midrash, using hermeneutical principles of learning from text to get to a certain place to understanding the law, I have two mentions of the words, they shall chasten, punish, and they'll chasten. Remember, in rabbinics, I have an ability to learn what happens in one case if I clarify what happens in another. And if a word is used in one verse over here in this part of Torah, and then over here in this other part of Torah, I can obviously understand that the result over here, because this word means the same as that word, is what's happening over here. This is called the Gezeirah Shavah. Gezeirah Shavah. So since it says, Vayisru mi ben, since it says in the verse concerning Ben Sorer More, the expressions and they chasten and son are written, U ben, umi ben, and then we associate the word son written in connection with Ben Sorer More with the word son written in connection with flogging. Flogging, in this case, if you look down, literally, that's when, if a man marries a wife and he spreads a bad name against her, and they shall chasten him. So, they're going to chastise this guy for what? Spreading a bad name about this woman. And what's the punishment? Flogging. Therefore, since it says the same verb over here in Ben Sorer More, the stubborn rebellious son, I actually say that the first step is flogging him. V'hayayim ben hakot harasha. And it shall be that if the guilty one is a son, he's liable to lashes. So I've now learned that. And so what I see, and I think we did have this question once, is, you know, kind of what's the process beforehand? Before you get to the 23, here's the process. Filled in for us. You had to see him drink this, you had to see him eat that, it had to be during this time when he was this years old, remember, not for a meal that was making a mitzvah, we limited, and plus, you had to have two witnesses, warn him before the two witnesses, bring him to the court of three had to flog him, and then and only then could you get. So again, if you're just packing on procedural default here as a possible defense, if someone were to say on behalf of the Ben Sorer Amore himself, listen, you guys, you saw me drinking the Italian wine, you saw me eating the meat, wasn't that a mitzvah meal? You really got me, right? Except that procedural default, you didn't bring me before the court of three.
Now that we see that the procedure takes him to a smaller court before he takes him to the small Sanhedrin, is the parents bringing as prosecutors. Who is standing with him as a sanhedrin, as somebody to protect him?
It's an interesting question. So far in the chapter, we have no, in essence, we have no description of what that procedure is. But we do have a little bit of that procedure outlined for us.
But court, when we study Dayanim, that court must have the two sides, not only that, each side has its own writers, and it's very separate, and each one...
Correct. So the question here is does this fit into any of those categories? Where do I go back to learn exactly what the setup is here? We know we're dealing with a bar mitzvah, maybe in the first 3 months of his being of age. Therefore, we could say that the normal structures and patterns of having representation, of having his side, is there. But we haven't received a description here that we did not have and that we don't have.
They will touch it, or it's...
Not really.
You may have touched on this question here, probably you did, but is it always a question of overconsumption of food and drink?
It's part of the requirement. And not only that, but he has to, in order to have the food and the drink, he's got to steal money, and the money's got to be stolen both from his mother and his father.
Right, but there's so many other behaviors that are bad.
Yeah.
Why is the Talmud focusing on
right.
this?
The question for us on that level is the Talmud at all in their intentionality leading us to think more widely about such issues and about the ills?
This is just such a simple example that you've met.
Yeah. I wanna think that the rabbis and hold that the rabbis really did have more in mind. But they also wanted to be very careful about setting up procedure legally and limiting the application of wanton prosecutorial power, especially with parents, in addition to even the law. So that's what's going on, small and large. That's the new part of this. It goes back to talking about measures of wine, measures of meat, where he got it, okay, what was the time that he brought him before 3, what was the time that then he goes to 23, nothing really new. It's a review until you get to the next Mishnah, which is 71b5. The Mishnah. A statement that we already had in the Talmud at the beginning and outset of our conversation, now shown, included on the daf, on the page, in the Mishnah form that it first came in. Now it's kind of like the chapter is revealed to you, and this is, by the way, where we got that argument from. What argument? That a ben sorer more is nidon al shem sofo. That a stubborn and rebellious son is judged on account of his ultimate end. Interestingly, to cap it all off, they're not going to end the chapter here, as I said, because what's fascinating about the rest of the chapter, which we'll get into the next time, is that it's this notion of whether or not I actually think through people's intentionality and what they were bound to do when they committed some crime that allows me to adjudicate not only for what it was that they did in terms of the law broken, but that which they might do, or at least, mea culpa, intentionality and what state of mind informs our being able to attach criminal penalty to any kind of criminality. The Mishnah here is, in essence, a cap of the conversation about this particular case. We're going to move on to a different one with that next Mishnah, but it's a philosophical reflection that is much like a good ending Mishnah. And there's no reason why the next Mishnah couldn't have been the beginning of the next chapter, except that Rabbi Yehuda, who's the ultimate editor of our Mishnah, thought that it was so philosophically connected that he didn't really end the Mishnah here. I'm pointing this out because I said the last class that beginnings and endings are very important. Beginnings and endings of Talmudic sugyas, in terms of large sections of Talmud and which sugya comes, what it says at the beginning, kind of what it says at the end of a discussion. Same holds true in these scholars' opinion for chapters of the Mishnah or unique, distinct sections of the Mishnah. I want to ask you what you make of this Mishnah. And I'm going to read it closely twice. Which is most surprising? Which makes sense? Are there any that don't make any sense? Because there's going to be some kind of statements here of what's good and what's not so good vis-a-vis society, and some of what we've been talking about vis-a-vis eating, drinking, what's good for one is good for another, is it? You'll see. So ben sorer more, really judged upon his ultimate end. Yamut zakai ve'al yamut chayav. Philosophically, or in our legal philosophy, let him die while he's innocent, and let him not die while he's guilty of a capital crime. Question. Why would that be? What philosophical position of the rabbis is that indicating? Interesting take. Let him die innocent, and not die while he's committed when he's committed a capital crime. Hold the thought. I'm going to read through the Mishnah.
That's the CIA.
Shmita tan shel rishaim hana'ala hen, v'hana'ala olam. The death of the wicked is beneficial to them and beneficial to the world. La tzadikim ra, ra lahen, v'ra la olam. And the death of the righteous is detrimental to them and detrimental to the world. Yayin v'shena l'rishayim, wine and sleep for the wicked. Hana'a lahen, v'hana'a la olam. Beneficial to them and beneficial to the world. La tzadikim ra lahem v'ra l'olam. But for the righteous, it's detrimental to them and detrimental to the world. Let's stop there for a second. Go back. First question. What do you make of the claim that someone should die while he's innocent? The Mishnah says this. Straight up, despite what the Gemara is going to say about it. Just let him die innocent and not die after a capital crime.
It's against capital punishment.
It's
a position against capital punishment.
How so?
It's the opposite.
Well, if you let the bad guy go and kill the wrong guy, then you say, can you make a decision on capital punishment at all?
You might not be able. I think we learned it's very difficult to convict somebody of the capital crime because there are no witnesses. Whereas for a Ben Sarera Moray, you have plenty of witnesses.
So you're presuming that this Ben Sarera Moray.
You didn't have DNA in those days.
Uh-huh.
You always make a mistake.
So instead of making the mistake after the capital crime, make the mistake now.
Don't make a mistake. Don't have a capital crime period for either side.
But I still have the state taking into its own hands, removing this man's life.
But it's,
well, maybe it's suggesting that we shouldn't do it. The state shouldn't do it.
But as Robert said, we learned earlier that the courts bent over backwards to try to not find a person guilty. So I don't quite get.
What we learned is there's no conviction based on circumstantial evidence. It gave the example, you see a man running, he runs into a building, you see a man chasing him with a knife, a dagger, you come in to try and the first man's lying dead and the second man has a knife dripping with blood, you did not witness a crime. You can't, whereas the incipient criminal, his behavior is visible to everybody, and I'm not going to say, I'm sure this was, we know they didn't execute him, but
right.
The logic kind of makes sense, you know, in a system where you must have two eyewitnesses to a crime,
mm-hmm.
and most criminals don't perform their crimes in the presence of witnesses who can identify them. Nip them in the bud before it causes problems. I don't know if that's their thinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'm exploring. What is their thinking?
Fascism.
Is their thinking that if I identify someone and I get three experts to say that this person is a true psychopath, then we can put him to death?
What we see now in Afghanistan and Iraq of blood feuds between clans where they will literally tell, in this case, the Americans that so-and-so is a collaborator, but there's not proof that he's a collaborator. It's more that there was an intra-group dispute or the person was marginalized. And so in this argument, you would still put that person to death even though he hasn't done a more affirmative act. And that's also what's happened in significant numbers in Afghanistan and Iraq.
So you're seeing it as a family or a clan issue?
A settling, whatever you want to call it, settling personal feuds, clan feuds. I mean, that has to, it seems to me, since we know it's prevalent in many societies, I think we can infer it was also prevalent among human nature then.
I have a question in regard. I think this section of the Mishnah is basically the repeating what we studied before with the summary.
Well, it was this section of the Mishnah was brought in the Gemara discussion that we saw.
Right. So, to have somebody die, to preventive measure. But my question to that is, statistically at that time, how many of those kids were criminals or Einsteins? I mean, we already know that Rabbi Yonatan was a troublemaker too.
Yeah, I mean, look, if we go with what the Gemara was just saying previously that we read tonight, it's not as though we're talking about a major proliferation of such a population and courts that would consistently invoke such measures. The Mishnah, which is the more foundational document of the Talmud and reflective of Tannaitic and pre-destruction systems of justice. And I say systems on purpose because what the Galil did in their court might be a little bit different than, say, another court elsewhere, and then at some point...
Yeah, but the Sanhedrin never sat down and heard that. I mean, the period of the Sanhedrin was... there is no really document that they really...
we're talking about courts of 3 and courts of 23 here.
Yeah, that's already established by the Sanhedrin, so it's...
We're talking about, though, a time that the Jewish people did pass out and adjudicate legal matters. And so the Mishnah stating such a position as a starting place for discussion led us to see what the Gemara ultimately did with that, reminding ourselves that this is Mishnah. And I think that what this line is pointing at really has more to do with their eschatology than any kind of sociological commentary on whether or not we're going to have problems with murderers within our cities. So, no, if I could just explain what I mean.
Sure, sure.
So, the rabbis are concerned that people should understand at least their conception, if not create one for themselves, of what happens when I die? What is the next world? What happens to me, my soul, when I face the Creator, when I give answers? And their statement that someone should die innocent versus die with a capital crime on their head is, at this point, to me, a statement more about, Mishnaically, about their views about what goes on afterwards than it even is about the nature of the criminal case.
Yeah, but the people who judge him to kill him, now they have blood on their hand while he was Zakai. So you have now three killers for somebody who is pure, clean.
And the question is whether or not anybody wants to go forward and answer to Kadosh Baruch Hu, to God, with any of this. And here it is, the Mishnah is not set out in Mishnah 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 at the beginning of the chapter, and then let's talk about this. The Mishnah is set into place here to say, hey guys, we didn't make that up back when we did bring it up in our Gemara discussion. Remember that we inherited this. And interestingly, the placement of the Mishnah here now after the conversation is, let's really reflect here what's going on. The rabbis, they were talking about not only the actual legal procedures and procedural default and whether or not I could bring this person up on charges. They actually were philosophizing. And we better put that back in here at this point. And how do we know that? Because the rest of the Mishnah is what's good for them and what's good for the world. They bring it back to a place out of the actual parlance of legalistic procedure for a moment by choosing to place the Mishnah within the Perek, within the chapter, by choosing to place the Mishnah after all the legal discussion, where they could have put it differently. The editorial board has, remember, that kind of power. So I think it reveals something of let's move out of this very legal discussion here for a moment and take the bigger picture again, both in terms of this world and the one to come.
It could be a non-sequitur. Mm-hmm. Let him die while he is innocent. And then, but the death of the wicked is beneficial. Is he wicked or is he innocent? Or are those two sentences not related?
Good. That's a great segue to the next part of the Mishnah, which the classic, you've hit upon a very classic question about that part of the Mishnah. Are we referring back to the one, and can we call him wicked even if he's innocent? Because the Mishnah just called him innocent. What's the problem I have with the next statement? If it's about this one individual case, can I really call him wicked? I can't be talking about this one who's wicked. I just said he was put to his death innocent. Thusly, I know I'm moving into a more philosophical discussion regarding the evildoers and the good tzaddikim of the world, the righteous ones of the world. It's absolutely a matter of Mishnaic parlance here to move to move out of the detail of one case. That it is.
There's no relation.
I think what it's saying is, okay, stop thinking about now one person, Ben Torah, Moreh or not. Move into now a much more philosophical discussion. So, for the death of the wicked is beneficial to them and beneficial to the world. What does that mean, it's beneficial to them?
They go before God with a clean slate that they haven't committed the crime.
Exactly.
For that matter, all of us are... but we all could do something, so why not kill us all?
We should kill us one of
the really, if you carry it to the end. Right?
I'm for the vote.
I'm against that.
Me too. At our age, I think we're pretty safe going forward.
That is part of the overarching, like, where could you bring any of this?
Where do you draw the line?
And we saw that come through the Gemara discussion. Yet, there's reflection. There's real reflection. How far do we go in making kind of law that really gets to the heart of this and making sure we take care of it? This is the challenge of any society, right? Beneficial to the world. Hana'a la'olam. So, hana'a is an interesting term, Mishnaically. It means benefit a la economic benefit. Hana'a also means derived benefit from a situation. Not necessarily kind of enjoyment like joy.
That's with hate.
I think this kind of decision that we're really talking about here, should we get rid of this guy, before something terrible happens, is a decision that's commonplace, in our society, whether it be military or law enforcement, this isn't an abstract, thing that we're talking about. We read about it in the papers every day.
Say more.
But there's nothing more to say, the police shoot some black guy, that they saw, doing something, it happens all the time.
Right.
Or we send a drone, to kill somebody that we've never tried before. This is a practical matter that's adjudicated by the society, on many, many levels, frequently.
I'm glad you took it to both local and global levels, because they were as well.
Oh, it's right here in New York.
Those people who are shot by the police are not being brought to court. And the court doesn't take preventive measure and say, okay, kill the guy.
But the whatchamacallit, but the society is doing it.
Right, okay. In a sense.
But that's through process. That's not through court.
It's the same type of decision that we're making here.
No, just along the same, somewhat of the same lines, it reminds me of the justifications that terrorists use to kill, quote, innocent people, or, and especially even children, because then they won't become, you know, the enemy as when they're adults. I mean, it's the same... To me, it's the same line of, quote, reasoning,
mm-hmm.
you know, chills me to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazis wiping out the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that willy-nilly the cops shoot people all the time, or is it a rare case like this Ben Stiller?
I don't think it's so rare, okay. I think it happens, you know, with enough frequency.
They shoot somebody unarmed.
Unarmed.
You see that in the movies a lot, right? That's Hollywood.
No,
wait. Before we go forward,
okay.
Excuse me, Richard.
Okay.
Richard, excuse me. Before we go forward, because
New York Times,
Hi, Richard. Before we go forward.
I mean, this is absurd.
Before we go forward, what I think is real over the course of history, which the rabbis are pointing to, is that possibilities exist for us either taking a position that we have to be more preventative in terms of legal systems, or we have to be sure about the way we adjudicate post-crime. This, I think, is the ultimate message on the local level. Whatever happens in whatever society, in whatever time, they're asking us to consider as people who will make law, as people who will argue about whether or not it's abused or not, as people who know that it happens on local levels because some people do on local levels this or that, and some people on national levels condone it, and it's from societies that we consider Western or societies that we consider terrorists. The rabbis are pointing out a philosophical understanding of humanity vis-a-vis the concept of law. And the Gemara was the largest law code of its time and of history, and wanted to talk about it in deeper ways, and the editors included both the foundational document and the discussions, and allowed for the legal discussion in addition to the cases to be shown on the pages, which is why we went through, and it sometimes even sounded very repetitive. They know that human beings have to really decipher this. Wine and sleep, again, very natural things. Will it be good for this one, good for that one? The next piece they get to is dispersal. Pizur l'rishaim is beneficial to them, beneficial to the world. You know, if we're not going to, if we're obviously dispersal of the wicked means what? We didn't kill them all. The Mishnah turns at a certain point. If they're going to be shared throughout society, and every society's got its own couple, that's good for them. That's good for the world. Assembly is detrimental to them and detrimental to the world, but for the righteous, beneficial to them and beneficial to the world. Tranquility for the wicked, sheket l'rishaim, ra lahen v'ra la'olam, it's detrimental to them and detrimental to the world. L'tzadikim hana'a lahen v'hana'a la'olam, but for the righteous, it's beneficial to them and beneficial to the world. The notion here is that the Mishnah ultimately is bringing out, again, the kinds of realities on the ground you're going to face. On a personal level, as a human, whether you're making gluttonous decisions, whether you're controlling your drinks of wine and becoming smart like the one example we had, and sharp, and it's the social lubricant that it could be and needs to be, or it's abused, or abused to the point of stealing and being making you corrupt, leading to murder. Systems of justice, whether or not they can procedurally deal with the kind of adjudication that would allow for either prevention or for taking the crime seriously. At the end of the day, I think, very deeply, the parallel in modern circles is really the question, and I've used the term tonight, about procedural default and the nature of human beings in terms of criminality. If we are going to react to crimes within society, do we have the right procedures in place? Can we see that we really can adjudicate in some type of just way? If not, lo haya, lo atid lihiyot. Never was, never will be. Meaning, don't do it. Don't put yourselves up to this. Don't create the system. If so, that you know this happens in the real world, and a couple examples exist where this happened by Rabbi Yonatan, by Rabbi Shimon, figure out the way to do it right, adjudicate it properly, because the world's at stake. This Mishnah makes the point. The world's at stake. The world's in your hands. God can't come down and be the judge of judges. Erev Tov.
Thank you.